Page 35. Procurers, condottieri, manual lords, and guilds have always protected and at the same time exploited their clients. Protection is the archetype of domination. After the interlude of liberalism, economic tendencies in Europe progressed toward a new and total protectionism. Only the great combine survived competition. They were strong enough to destroy the separation of powers and the network of guarantees and rights. The monopolies and their government constituted an impenetrable jungle for the masses. The magnitude and diversity of the task of the prevailing cliques, the all-embracing character of which still distinguishes them from racketeering, turns into a comprehensive planning, on the one hand, and on the other into an attack on mankind as such. This is an inevitable result of the economic development itself. The same sociological mechanism applied to the monopoly and to the city racket. The latter had previously shared the spoils with other rackets of the same branch, but the growth of communication and the progressing centralization of the police made it impossible to continue with small bribes and the procurement of new henchmen and guns. The racket was forced to mechanize its business and to undertake the costly task of affiliating it to large political organizations. Such investments are profitable only if the spoils do not have to be divided. In the racket, cartelization asserts itself. The rackets in the cities and in the entire country are driven to unification unless the police succeed in eradicating them in time. A study of such border phenomena as racketeering may offer useful parallels for understanding certain developmental tendencies in modern society. As soon as the concentrated power of large property has reached a certain point, the struggle continues on a broader scale and develops under the pressure of giant investments necessitated by the progress of technology into the struggle for world conquest, interrupted only by periods of precarious compromise. From this point on, the differences of goals and ideals within the power hierarchy recede before the differences in the degree of docility. The elites must see to it, even against their own will, that in the social order everything is rigidly coordinated. Under totalitarian conditions of society, reliability decides upon the allocation of all positions of trust, whether a manager of a provincial factory is to be appointed or the head of a puppet government. Side by side with efficiency, human qualities of a kind again win respect, particularly a resolution to go along with the powerful at any cost. For the trustees, a mere delegates, he who is worthy of his task is not to show any traces of that which the self-criticism of reason has destroyed. Page 36. He must embody the self-preservation of a whole that has become identical with the liquidation of humanity. At the beginning of the history of modern rackets stands the inquisitioners, at its end the fascist leaders. Their henchmen, living their lives face to face with catastrophe, have to react correctly until they fall victim to the rational principle that none may abide too long. Present-day contempt of reason does not extend to purposive behavior. The term mind, insofar as it designates an intellectual faculty or an objective principle, appears as a meaningless word unless it refers to a coordinating of ends and means. The destruction of realistic dogmatism through the self-criticism of reason, carried out by the ever-renewed nominalistic tendencies in philosophy, has now been ratified by historical reality. The substance of individuality itself, to which the idea of autonomy was bound, did not survive the process of industrialization. Reason has degenerated because it was the ideological projection of a false universality, which now shows the autonomy of the subject to have been an illusion. The collapse of reason and the collapse of individuality are one and the same. The ego is unsavable, and self-preservation has lost its self. For whom can an action still be useful if the biological individual is no longer conscious of itself as an identical unit? Throughout its various stages of life, the body possesses only a questionable identity. The unity of individual life has been social rather than natural one. When the social mechanism which made for this unity are weakened as they are today, the individual concerns for this self-preservation changes its meaning. What previously served to promote man's development, the joy in knowledge, living through memory and foresight, pleasure in oneself and others, narcissism, as well as love, are losing their content. Neither conscience nor egoism is left. The moral law has become inadequate for those who are supposed to obey it, and the authority which it previously invoked has disappeared. Morality had to disappear, since it did not conform with its own principle. It pretended to be independent of empirical individuals, unconditionally universal, but its universal form perpetuated antagonism among individuals and tyranny over men and nature. It is vain to hope that in better times men will return to morality. Yet even in fascism it has left its traces within men, and these at least have been freed of spurious positivity. Morality has survived insofar as men are conscious that the reality to which they yield is not the right one. Nietzsche proclaimed the death of morality. Modern psychology has devoted itself to exploring it. Psychoanalysis has the adjustment form of modern skepticism, triumphed over moral law through its discovery and unmasking of the father in the superego. Page 37. This psychology, however, was the owl of Minerva, which took its flight when the shades of dark were already gathering over the whole sphere of private life. The father may still possess a superego, but the child has long unmasked it. Together with the ego and the character, today the child imitates only performances and achievements. He accepts not ideas, but matters of fact. With the disappearance of independent economic subjects, the subject as such disappears. It is no longer a synthetic unit. It has become senseless for it to preserve itself for some distant future or to plan for its heirs. In the present period, the individual has opportunities only on short term. Once secure property has vanished, as the goal of acquisition, the intrinsic connection between the experiences of the individual disappears. Concern for property under orderly competition and the rule of law has always been constitutive of the ego. Slaves and paupers had no individuality. The premise of all my acting in the sensuous world can only be as part of that sensuous world if I live amongst other free things. This determined part of the world is called my property. Footnote 14. Text. The concept of the ego must also will a future state to exist, which shall have resulted from the present state. in consequence of the rule which he followed when he resolved upon his act of casuality. Footnote 15. Text. Property and the orderly function of property relations were the references of the notion of one's own past and future. Today, the individual ego has been absorbed by the pseudo-ego of totalitarian planning. Even those who hatch the totalitarian plan, despite and because of the huge mass and capital over which they dispose, have as little autonomy as those they control. The latter are organized in all sorts of groups, and in these the individual is but an element possessing no importance in himself. If he wants to preserve himself, he must work as part of a team, ready and skilled in everything, whether in industry, agriculture, or sport. In every camp, he must defend his physical existence. His work, eating and sleeping place must give and take cuffs and blows and submit to the toughest discipline. The responsibility of long-term planning for himself and his family has given way to the ability to adjust himself to mechanical tasks of the moment. The individual constricts himself without dream or history. He is always watchful and ready, always aiming at some immediate practical goal. His life falls into a sequence of data which fit in advance the questionnaire he has to answer. He takes the spoken word only as a medium of information, orientation, and command. The semantic dissolution of language into a system of signs, as undertaken by modern logistics, transcends the realm of logic. It draws its conclusion from a state of affairs which surrenders language to the rule of monopoly. Page 38. To be accepted, men must sound like the vocal cords of the radio, film, and magazines. For, in point of fact, no one seems to make his living by himself, and everyone is suspect in mass society. Everyone needs a permanent alibi. The individual no longer has any future to care for. He has only to be ready to adapt himself, to follow orders, to pull levers, to perform ever different things which are ever the same. The social unit is no longer the family, but the atomic individual, and the struggle for life consists in his revolving not to be annihilated at any moment in the world of apparatuses, engines, and handles. Bodily strength is not the chief point, but it is important enough. To a large extent, it is not a natural quality. It is a product of the social division of labor, one that is necessary for production and supplied by whole strata of society to whom no other reason for existence was left except to supply it. Those among the dominated strata who excel in brute force reflect the injustice that the axe which treads out the corn has always been muzzled. Culture was the attempt to tame this element of brute force immanent in the principle of bodily strength. Such taming, however, concealed the fact that physical exertion remained the kernel of work. The counterpart of this concealment was the glorification of bodily strength in ideology, expressed in encomia to every brand of greatness, intellectual giants as well as muscle men at county fairs, in Wagner's Gesamtkunstwerk, in the Monster Stadium. Today the ideological veil has been lifted and the principle of bodily strength has been openly propagated in the form of strong-arm methods and purchase. Contemporary individuals, however, need presence of mind even more than muscles. The ready response in what counts, affinity to every kind of machine, technical, athletic, political. Previously, men were mere appendages to the machine. Today, they are appendages as such. Reflective thought and theory lose their meaning in the struggle for self-preservation. 50 years ago, psychological experience, skillful argumentation, foresight in business were still instruments of progress in society. Prior to the mechanization of the office, even the account had